You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast with Jason and Jamie. This is episode 109, and we're going to continue the discussion we started last time in episode 108 on the topic of what we're calling the secular creed. And as you recall, Jason read it to us. It's signs you often see in people's yards, or as Jason pointed out, more often in the more urban type settings, not as much so much in rural areas. So you may not be as familiar with it, but the sign says, "In this house, we believe that Black Lives Matters, that women's rights are human rights. No human is illegal. Science is real and love is love." And these signs are meant to really present well the viewpoint of our culture, which is to say, this is what justice and progress looks like in a secular mindset. So those who are not connected with the Lord Jesus Christ or yielding to the authority of Scripture. And we dealt last week with the Black Lives Matters part of that. So I'd encourage you to go back and listen to that episode if you haven't already. And at the same time, also check out our other episodes on that topic or similar topics to it. They're all linked in the show notes to that episode. It's episodes 60, 61, and 62. So you can also go check those out as well. But in this episode, we want to deal with that next line on the question or the statement, women's rights are human rights. Now, Jason, as we've pointed out in the last episode, as it relates to, you know, these statements, they sound really good on their face. Like, who doesn't believe in women's rights? Who doesn't believe in treating women well? Unfortunately, that's not actually what the statements really mean. What it means, at least as understood in a cultural lens, is that women's rights are really defined in terms of a woman being able to have and use and be and behave any way she likes without any sort of question, retribution, or disagreement. Primarily, I think most commonly, you hear this argument as it relates to the topic of abortion and whether a woman has the right to terminate the life of a human inside her body or not. And so, on its face, it seems like we should agree with this statement, and actually we will argue that the Bible holds women in very high esteem and actually calls us as men to treat women in line with that status, which is a beautiful thing and certainly God's design for human flourishing. And when done properly, it ends up being a great blessing to us in the church, in the home, in the culture and community at large. And so that's kind of the beginning point to bring up this discussion. Jason, I am curious, you know, you're much more familiar with these signs. We talked about that last week, how I haven't really seen so much of these signs around. You know, most of the signs I see are rural Americans against racism or something like that, you know, which is sort of that more rural context, because that's where I live. I live in farm country with all them hicks. So love y'all, by the way. I'm one of y'all, by the way, just to make that real clear there. But how do you see a statement like this specifically as it relates to women's rights or human rights? Where do you see that most often used, and what is it really meant to argue?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think in context, we have to see that there is the looming issue of the abortion debate that's certainly at stake with all of this. And in the secular mindset, abortion would most commonly be thought of as a woman's reproductive right. That term reproductive right was coined by Gloria Steinem, who was obviously one of the biggest feminist activists from the 60s, 70s, and beyond. So that's definitely a looming issue. And I guess in starting to talk about this, I think that's important to just make clear that we'll talk about that. And there's many issues related to women's rights. Obviously, first wave feminism back in the 20s, in the era of women's suffrage, you know, women wanting the right to vote. That there's an interesting history behind all that that I think a lot of people are not aware that much of the activism that happened at that time was actually rooted in Christian thinking and biblical thinking. And then feminism over time has sort of warped and shaped to different secular perspectives. And it really doesn't have at all the character of the feminism of the early stages when women said things like, we want the right to vote and the responsibility that comes with that. We want the equal opportunity and the equal sense of dignity that goes with that. And then that was really the big emphasis is equality, value and quality of contribution. When it comes to the issue of abortion, that's obviously something where, you know, as we see it, and again, we're coming at the issue of abortion and this whole idea of women's rights from a diametrically opposed perspective. Like we believe in women's rights in the sense of because we believe women are made in the image of God. We talked about this last week about human rights and how we come to the question even of racism from a totally different perspective than the secularist would. But at the same time, I think it's important to point out that this whole idea of women's rights, it's rooted in scripture. It's rooted in this idea, like we said, the image of God, and also the way that Jesus treated women, first and foremost, and then how his followers treated women. Many people don't realize this, but the majority of the early church was female. So the first few hundred years, you're talking about mostly women packing into those little house churches. And the irony behind all that is that there were far more men in the Greco-Roman world because the honest answer is because females were not preferred, and so they were more likely to be left out to exposure as after they were born, because men were seen as better assets in the home, better assets in the workforce, better assets in politics, all these reasons, carrying on the family name, all these things. So the fact that there were more women in the early church tells us that they were finding a home where they're actually treated with equality and they're treated with value. Let me just give you one example from the Gospels and then we can kind of work from there. But there's the time when Jesus in Luke chapter 10, Luke, by the way, has many examples of Jesus interacting with women in a way that was totally countercultural at the time. But in Luke 10 verse 38, it says, "Now as they went on their way, Jesus entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving, and she went up to him and said, 'Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me.' But the Lord answered her, 'Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her.'" Now, what we need to understand is in our cultural context, it's like, okay, yeah, women being confined to all the household chores like cooking, cleaning, whatever, that would be seen as this patriarchal idea. This maybe some would even say that's oppressive to say that's the woman's job. And here, Jesus is actually affirming Mary and her decision to sit at his feet and learn, to use her intellectual ability, to use her desire to learn from the Lord and to sit at his feet rather than do the household chores. And so from a traditional perspective, this would be crazy talk to say, oh yeah, she's doing the right thing. In fact, he says it's the one thing that's necessary. The one thing that's necessary. In other words, she is prioritizing her relationship with me. She's prioritizing learning from me and walking with me and following me. You're prioritizing simply what are traditional women roles. Okay. And so Jesus is actually going up against the culture of that time, the traditional mindset, and saying, no, women have the right, if you will, to learn from me. They have the opportunity. It's the good thing to do, to learn and follow me. And going on from there, we could bring up many more examples, like the Samaritan woman that Jesus approached. Totally unheard of in the day for a Jew to approach a Samaritan, but also for a man who's a rabbi to approach a woman who was known for being in multiple marriages. It was just, in the traditional context, that would be bizarre. And yet he did it. He crossed these cultural barriers as if to say, no, I don't look at women that way. They're not inferior. They are not, sir. They are just like you men. They need my love. They need my attention. That set the trajectory for the early church. The way Jesus treated women, totally against the culture at the time. And by the way, you can study out history, and guys like Rodney Stark have done a good job charting this out. But women throughout history, by and large, have been treated as inferior or in some way secondary to men. That doesn't mean they're always treated as slaves. Sometimes they were, or always treated as the owners or the property, I should say, of the husbands. But they were sometimes. And you know, you can bring up exceptions, I'm sure, to that rule where, you know, there's certain cultures I hear about in Africa or South America where only the woman could rule or something like that. Sure, there's exceptions. But I'm talking about the general trend throughout ancient cultures was that women were treated as lesser. That's just a fact. You can study this out. But Jesus and his followers began to change all that. And I'm going to turn it back to you, Jamie, because this is just sort of giving you the biblical roots and helping you understand this is where it came from.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I really, we want to encourage as well, those who are, you know, more interested in a more thorough discussion of that particular topic. What does the Bible say about the value of women? We did a full episode on the topic of if the Bible is against women, or if the Bible is chauvinistic, or, you know, that sort of thing. So go check out that episode as well, where we fully dive into exactly what Jason is talking about. And one of the things we talk about in there is the fact that if you score up, I mean, if you're able to score up, if there was a way to do that, all the commands about the value of women and how women are to be treated versus all the commands about the value of men and how men are to be treated, what you find is that dramatically, there are many, many more commands where God says, hey, you men, love women, serve women, care for the women, pour out your life for the women, all this sort of stuff. So this idea of women are somehow a second-class citizen in the Bible is absolutely cultural nonsense made up by people who've never read the Bible and repeated by people that also don't know the truth of this. I thought it was great. I was talking to a guy the other day, and he was talking about how somebody came up and told him that there were many errors in the Bible, and that's why he didn't believe it. And he asked him, okay, let me know, you know, what ones you're talking about, and we can, you know, do some research on that and look into that. And he said, well, I don't know. You know, the guy didn't know. And this is so often the case when it comes to the issue of women and the Bible as well. In fact, I've had several debates, even one in our local newspaper. There was a woman who published, actually, I don't even know if it was a woman, actually, it could have been a man, I don't know, but published a letter to the editor arguing that the Bible treats women poorly. You know, the Bible is somehow chauvinist or horrible to women. And His main argument was obviously over the word submission, and making a huge hay about that. And so I actually responded to his letter as another letter. And so we had a sort of old-fashioned debate in the paper that way, really just talking about how the word submission is actually used more of Jesus Christ than it is even in reference to women in the Bible, and certainly that did not delineate a difference in value. And we talk about that in that other episode as well. So the point is just to say, as Jason's pointing out, not only does the Bible challenge cultural norms as it relates to women, but it actually treats women better. And I would say that's true even to this day, where cultural feminism has actually been worse to women, in my opinion, than what you see as biblical respect for women. So, and there's lots of different ways that relates. But I want to switch real quick here because we don't have tons of time for this. Like I said, go back and listen to that episode. We talked about it, dealt with that topic pretty thoroughly there. Yeah, but I want to talk about the topic of abortion. We've mentioned it. And this is one topic where this particular phrase comes up all the time. In fact, you hear the, you know, it's my body, my choice mantra repeated so much. And I've even heard Christians say, well, the Bible never uses the word abortion and doesn't call abortion sin. There's not, abortion is not a word in the Bible. And that's actually absolutely true. The word abortion is not at all in the Bible. However, that does not mean human life is not in the Bible. In fact, the Bible speaks about the topic of life and human life and the value of life, all life, a lot. And I want to point out real quick, you know, at the start of this to say the main reason that God values life so much is because God is the God of life. And that sounds like no duh, right? In terms of if you know the Bible at all, you know that the whole story of the gospel, the whole story of the Word of God is to tell the story of a God who intervenes on behalf of a sinful humanity and restores them, redeems them, buys them back to himself, draws them back to himself, and takes what is dead and brings it back to life. But more fundamentally than that, God in his own character and nature has been a God of life since the very beginning. Now, God, from a Christian perspective, is a Trinitarian God. It's one God, yet eternally three persons. There's a Father, Son, and Spirit. They are the same in essence, the same in substance, still monolithic, still one God, yet eternally existing as three persons. And the main characteristic we find of the Father is that the Father has eternally been pouring out his love and life-giving nature. I mean, you think of, you know, Jesus points to this reality in lots of different ways. One example is in John chapter 5, verse 26, where Jesus is talking about how he is able to bring life because the Father has poured out life into him. And as a result, he can pour it out into others. Or even John 17, you know, 24, where Jesus is talking about how the Father was eternally loving since before even the creation of the world. So for all eternity, this has been true of God. For all eternity, he has been pouring out life. And so the value of human life, this goes back to what Jason was talking about in the last episode, the value of human life is inseparable from the character and nature of God, the reality of God, the sovereignty of God. Apart from that, there is no value to human life. In this case, we're saying God is very much a God of life, but not just a God of life in a general sense. He's a God of life in a specific sense. I mean, you think of like Psalms 139, for example, you know, where you see God is intimately aware of a human before they're even born. While they're still in the mother's womb, God knows them. Or Isaiah 49, same thing, verse 1 and verse 5, God knows them deeply personally. Jeremiah 1, 4 and 5, you know, Proverbs 24, 11 and 12. You just see this. This is a God who absolutely loves, cares for, and is pouring out for even while they're still in their mother's womb, even while they're not, you know, their own independent being. And at the same time, the Bible also speaks to the reality of murder. If you murder a pregnant woman and the baby also dies, that's a double murder. in the Bible. If you hurt a woman where a baby dies, that's murder. I mean, Exodus 21, 22 through 25, Leviticus 24, 19 through 20, Deuteronomy 19, 18 through 21. I mean, the Bible talks about this so much.
Well, yeah, and I just think of the example of when Jesus is in the womb of Mary, when Mary goes to see Elizabeth and, John leaping within the womb because the baby already being filled with the Spirit. It's so clear from Scripture that the baby in the womb, calling it a fetus might be a tactic to dehumanize that human being in the womb, but in the reality, fetus just means offspring. It's not as though this is a term for a clump of cells or something else like pro-abortionists might want you to think. The fact is, it's the taking of a human life, that baby in the womb. Anytime an abortion is done, you are eliminating the life of a fully developed, in terms of DNA, that has already been put together. The DNA is there from the beginning. You have a new human being, half a chromosome is taken from the mom, half from the dad. It's a new entity within the womb. It's not that this is in the process of becoming a human. This is a human being from the beginning. Science will tell you that. The eye color, the gender, the hair color, all of these things are built into the DNA from the moment of conception. So that should tell us, yeah, stages of development still have to happen, but after birth, that's still the case, right? And a lot of times the argument is something along these lines. Well, until the baby is viable. Well, here's a big problem with that. If it's all based on viability, first of all, a newborn infant is not viable on its own. You can't just send the little newborn off into the world because they're able to take care of themselves. Of course, they're dependent on their parents for many years, in fact. But viability, if you even say like, okay, well, outside the womb viability. But the problem with that is now you're saying that in a village in Africa where they don't have access to a NICU, early birth, we'll say 25 months, baby born at 25 months, that's not viable because they don't have the technology, the medical instruments available that they would in, say, Los Angeles. You're saying that the value of a human life is based on location, so that the baby born in California is a true human being and worthy of dignity, respect, and value, but the baby born in Africa, just because it doesn't have access to a NICU, that somehow is not viable or not a true human being. That whole argument totally breaks down, and it's one more sham. Frankly, the whole idea of the movement being called pro-choice is a sham. It's not pro-choice. If you go to a Planned Parenthood clinic, they will advise you to get an abortion. Like that is their go-to. They don't give you all the options of, look, here's all the benefits of adoption. Here's the benefits of keeping the child and they don't tell you the negatives of the emotional trauma, the heartache that comes with abortion. And I think it's just worth pointing out because, here we are two men talking about this. Some will try to argue, well, of course you're against abortion, you're men. And I even have had this happen when I was praying at a Planned Parenthood clinic. A girl drove up and, we were just peacefully there, willing to talk with anybody. And she saw me and another guy and said, how ironic that there's a bunch of men here. Well, what she didn't see, it was a rainy day, is that under the hoods of the three other people with us were these girls that were with us. And again, it's just, it paints it as this is men oppressing women who are in the pro-life movement. When in fact, if you look at the majority of these pro-life organizations, like Oregon Right to Life, for example, or Live Action, or so many others, you see that women who are pro-life are leading these efforts, spearheading these efforts. And by the way, some of the original feminists, you might call them the true feminists, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, so many more, Elizabeth Blackwell, they were all very, very pro-life, staunchly pro-life. This is what Elizabeth Cady Stanton said. It is degrading to women that we should treat our children as property to be disposed of as we fit. She even called abortion infanticide. Susan B. Anthony said that abortion burdens the woman's conscience and life and soul in death. Sarah Norton took a similar position. Elizabeth Blackwell said that she was so filled with indignation over what she called the gross perversion and destruction of motherhood by the abortionist. Okay, those are the original feminists speaking. They were as pro-life, as staunchly pro-life as you can be. And yet today it's framed as a women's rights issue, as if, for example, here's how it's often framed. Men can just walk away after a sexual liaison and there's no cost to them. For a woman who's been impregnated by that man, she has to bear that cost. And so for there to be equality, she should be able to walk away just as much as him. And see, while some people may say, well, that sounds like good logic, what you're really saying is the problem isn't that the man's walking away. The problem is that women need to be able to walk away as well. But just think about the logic of that. You're not calling out the evil of walking away. You're actually saying, yes, we need more of that. And this is what is often the way, at least when I've talked with pro-choice advocates, they often say, you know, you're not thinking of the women who have been abandoned. But here's the thing. If you want to promote men staying committed to women who they sleep with, then by all means, you should be pro-life. Because this is about holding men accountable and holding women accountable. But every time you engage in sex with someone else, there's always going to be the possibility. Now, people say, well, you know, you can eliminate with contraception. Actually, you can't totally eliminate the chance of getting pregnant. And so what you need to have is men stepping up and women stepping up both. That's the right way. That's how a society functions and flourishes. That's the reason that you're in this world. It's not because your mom and your dad walked away. It's actually because one or both of them stepped up. That's what we want more of, not the opposite. And so to say we need equality in terms of both get to walk away, that's wrongheaded. That's asking for more destruction of life and more degradation of and just viewing human life as something that we can dispose of when it's convenient.
Yeah, it is. All those arguments you pointed out, Jason, are just crazy, but yet we hear them all the time, you know, as if speaking back to your point where so many, and this comes up anytime you're talking to a pro-choice person, man or woman, they say, oh, you're a man. You don't have women reproductive system, so you don't get to speak on this issue. And you say that logically makes zero sense. So does truth change based on who's delivering that truth? I mean, that would be as dumb as me saying, oh, you don't have a college degree, therefore you can't speak truth to me. That doesn't make any sense, right? Or you're not a policeman, therefore you can't say anything about the law. That doesn't make any sense. None, you know, the logic literally doesn't work. It may sound good to some out there as a justification for a particular position, but it doesn't logically hold any water at all. You know, truth is the same whether you want to believe it or not. You know, the moment a sperm cell gets inside the egg, you have life already developed and developing in just boom, that moment, you know, within 24 to 48 hours, that egg has bonded with the uterine wall. Life is already forming. It's already happening. And that's science. And the last line of this, which we'll get to in another episode, is that we believe in science. Okay, well, science says this is human life. That's a fact. Whether it's told to you by a man or a woman or whatever, I mean, that doesn't change the reality of that. And then on the other side, you know, your other point relating to they should have the, you know, the right to equally walk away. They're not asking for better behavior, like you pointed out. They're not asking for better behavior. They're just saying, oh, we want to be equally irresponsible. Wait, what? That doesn't make any sense And even more, what doesn't make sense is last year at the Super Bowl, it was Jennifer Lopez was performing. She was performing, and if you recall, I don't know if you watched it, Jason, or not, but she did this exotic, empowering pole dance, right? That's what happened. And this was celebrated as the ultimate of female empowerment. This beautiful moment where women got to stand proud and strong and independent. And what cracked me up, absolutely cracked me up, is you read all these comments on, you know, social media where all these men were applauding, celebrating women empowerment, you know, literally cheering this on. Yes, women, pole dance, that is empowering. Yes, dress sexual and provocative, that's empowering, that's wonderful. And the funny thing, of course, is who's getting the most out of this quote-unquote female empowerment? Well, the men are, right? We get the opportunity to see incredibly beautiful women, you know, really sexually degrade themselves on live TV, and that's called empowerment.
Yeah. Again, this is the sham. It's called women empowerment, but think about this. Which promotes male oppression more? Holding men accountable for being the fathers of their children, if they're the ones that had sex, you know, holding them accountable for being that father that needs to step up and be responsible, or is it the man who says, go ahead, here's $500, go ahead and get an abortion, take care of it, you know, and then there's just commitment-free sex on every level. So in what sense is the pro-life position in any way supporting male oppression of women? See, this is something I'm just going to ask you, if maybe this is something where this is, you've never thought about it this way, but is it possible that the whole idea of women's rights as it's talked about today has been hijacked, not by true feminists who love and care about women, but by men, powerful men who are billionaires, frankly, making tons of money, yes, off of things like abortion and the porn industry and so many other things, and they cloak it in the language of female empowerment because that's what sounds culturally acceptable. Look at the data on this. Even though the women's liberation movement, for example, from the 60s and onward, it talked about free sex and commitment-free sex. And it made it sound like this is this great thing, like, oh, finally women have been, you know, they've been oppressed in these patriarchal societies all these years, and now they're free to have sex with whoever they want. But think about this. Does a woman really want to be with a man who doesn't have to commit to her, who can just go on to the next woman in his next sexual encounter? Or does she want to be in a committed relationship, what the Bible calls the covenant of marriage? And statistically, this is just the facts again, on average, this is something the Huffington Post put out, on average, married people have more and better sex than their unmarried peers. See, that flies in the face of this whole narrative of women's rights equals free sex and liberation. It's actually the opposite. It's enslaving to women in the sense it's degrading. It treats them more as property to say, men don't have to commit to them to have sex with them. They don't have to be the fathers and step up of the children forged from that union. All of that is degrading to women. I don't know. I don't understand, in fact, why so many people are still using that language, because it's obviously detrimental to women. And it's just, again, statistically, women have reported greater levels of anxiety, stress, and depression in the years since the sexual liberation movement began in the 60s than before. So we have to ask ourselves, is this actually better for women, or is it all a sham?
Yeah, I think along with that is you see a lot of women that put up with abuse, that put up with horrific relationships that are, you know, very toxic, that are abusive, that are, I mean, I've seen so many women in my life. You know, people I know in the community or know from church or knew growing up or knew from high school or, you know, whatever, that have lived in these relationships that are awful, that are terrible. They're like, the men are not men. The men are not loving, caring, serving, willing to pour out their life for them. And instead, they're abusive, they're domineering, they're entitled, they're so on and so forth. It just gets worse and worse and worse. And I'm always like, why, you know, I always think, why do they put up with this? Why do they put up with this? Because women, like you're saying, the women really actually have the power in all of this. I don't know, Jason, if you're familiar with, there's a YouTube video called The Economy of Sex. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but basically the argument is if women started demanding and be expecting men to behave better, they would, and they would end up ultimately, you know, getting more of that equality, more of that better treatment that they're hoping for because they demand it. You know, don't just be going around having sex with any guy just in the hopes that he'll have a relationship with you or stay with you or, you know, give you value, because they're not going to. The guys, when they can get away with that, generally speaking, they don't end up valuing you. They don't end up respecting you. They don't end up caring about you. Versus the women that do expect that, they're the women that usually get it as a result of, hey, the guys realize, oh, if I want to have sex or engage or have a relationship with a woman, then I have to actually be a man and actually be responsible and actually step up and do what God calls me to do.
And just a personal word to those. So maybe you're listening and you're in a crisis pregnancy situation, and say your boyfriend or significant other or whatever, he's walked out on you. He's left you alone. Well, here's the time when you need to know there are people who will care for you and love you and will encourage you, yes, to have the baby, but more than that, they will encourage you and affirm you, your value, and will be supportive the whole step of the way. You know, I'm in Albany and I have Options Pregnancy Resource Center is a great clinic like that. They actually show the woman the baby on the ultrasound. They show that it is a human life. By the way, that's something Planned Parenthood never does. You know, it's interesting, isn't it, that they would want to hide an ultrasound from a pregnant woman. And they say that's oppressive to show them the ultrasound. Look, it's called reality. It's showing the truth of the matter. But if you're in that situation, know that there's also so many churches, countless churches that will love and accept you and embrace you. And I know the caricature, and this is true, certainly of some churches, they would be scorning of a woman who's pregnant outside of wedlock. But I'm going to guess that you would find a surprising number, if they're Bible-believing, genuine followers of Jesus, they are going to love and embrace you and just be so thankful that you are reaching out to them and that they're going to help you along the way. And just to know that, you know, adoption is always an option. There are so many prospective parents right now who want to adopt, want to take care of a baby. They just can't have a baby through biological circumstances. They can't. And so they would be happy to have your baby. So just please know that's there are options available, and that's, you know, why the clinic is named that. Whereas if you go to a Planned Parenthood clinic, they're not going to give you options. They're going to essentially tell you what you should do based on their quote unquote feminist agenda, which is not truly for women.
And then ultimately, you know, recognize that the one who loves you most and values you most is God himself, the very God who poured out his life for you, that sent the Son to the cross to die for your sins so that you could be reconciled in relationship to him. The God who says, hey, here is my best for your flourishing, for the best human flourishing, for your good and my glory. That relationship and invitation is very much available to you. And the best part is there's no, oh, but it's only for those who haven't made mistakes. It's only for those who haven't sinned. It's only for those who haven't even committed murder in the form of abortion, recognize that God is calling you. If you've already killed a baby, whether you were, you know, doing so willfully or didn't know at the time that it really was human life, that this God died for you, died for that sin. He literally went to the cross knowing you were going to do that and still says, hey, I love you. I want you to be a part of my family. I want you to be reconciled in relationship to me. I want you to know that there is still a restored path back to God's beautiful design for your good and ultimately for his glory.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, you can find them on our website at faithunpacked.com. We'd also invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting site. If you have any questions, feel free to hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. And we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.